Nantucket, Tabitha. She has been invited to a cocktail party on the Belle, a 77-foot wooden motor yacht built in 1929 that is now used for entertaining by members of the Westmore Club. This evening's soiree is being thrown by people Tabitha barely knows, and it's still rather chilly to be out on the harbor. But ever since Tabitha broke up with Ramsay, she has been desperate to get out of the house. Ramsay will be sitting at the bar at the Strait Wharf, waiting for Kaylee to finish her shift. Tabitha was the one to break things off, yet Ramsay has rebounded far more quickly. Instantly, in fact. For the 3 years Tabitha and Ramsay dated, Tabitha teased him about wanting someone younger, which he denied. And yet Kaylee, a name fit for a chew toy as far as Tabitha is concerned, is only 22. When Tabitha was 22, she was roundly pregnant. She had never had a chance to spend a summer bartending or get a tattoo. She never had the opportunity to break away from her mother's fashion empire and pursue her own passions, real estate, architecture, interior design. And then when she was 25, she endured a tragedy from which she still hasn't recovered. Ramsay knew about Julian, and he knew it was a void that could never be filled. Or so Tabitha had thought. But on a frigid night this past February, when they had both been sober, and there wasn't even alcohol to blame, Ramsay had said, "The only way to put your sadness behind you is to start fresh. Let's have a baby." There had been no point in responding. He didn't get it. He would never get it, Tabitha realized. She gave him the "we want different things" talk, and 2 days later, he moved out. The party isn't bad. The host and hostess are from Tallahassee, so by nature they find New England brisk. Hence, they've provided a pile of cashmere wraps in optimistic summertime hues, cantaloupe, fuchsia, aquamarine, for the female guests on the boat to borrow. There is an endless supply of very cold Laurent Perrier Rosé and a piped-in soundtrack of Sinatra and Dean Martin that Tabitha just loves. Because she had no youth, she has adopted the tastes of her mother, Eleanor. Eleanor is a woman of refinement by anyone's standards, but she is 71 years old, and at times Tabitha fears that she has not only skipped her own youth, but her middle age as well, and landed squarely in the era of hip replacements and hearing aids. While Ramsay was packing up his things to leave, he delivered a speech in which he enumerated every one of Tabitha's flaws. She is egregiously snobby. She is uptight. She panders to the whims and wishes of her mother. She has spent her entire adult life in the woman's shadow. She has been a tireless handmaiden in service to Eleanor Roxy Frost Designs, LLC, yet the boutique on Nantucket loses money every year. Tabitha has no business sense. She has run the store into the ground. Ramsay himself had lent her $40,000 so that she might expand the store's inventory beyond the ERF label. "And don't forget, you still owe me that money," Ramsay said. "I know," Tabitha responded, although she was pretty sure Ramsay understood that with a child to send to college, it would take her a very long time to pay him back. As his parting shot, Ramsay had said, "It's a good thing you don't want any more children," he said. "You're a piss-poor mother, Tabitha." She knew he was angry and hurt and heartbroken, but the unbuffered cruelty of this statement forced her to respond, "How dare you?" He said, "Maybe with me gone, you can get your daughter under control." The food on the boat is delicious. Lamb lollipops, lobster corn cakes, gougere, deviled eggs. Tabitha helps herself judiciously. Ramsay was kind enough not to mention the 15 pounds she's gained over the past 3 years as she scans the crowd for eligible men to talk to. Ramsay wasn't wrong about her lack of business sense. What she needs, more than anything, is to either hit the lottery or find a sugar daddy. Pickings on the boat are slim. All the men are older and seem well off, but they're also married. Then most of them are from Tallahassee, which rules them out immediately. Tabitha has the bartender fill her glass of champagne. Then she heads out to the bow of the boat alone. They are just rounding Brant Point Light, coming upon a vista so magnificent, it takes Tabitha's breath away despite the hundreds of times she's seen it. She leans her elbows on the railing and holds her champagne out with both hands. She closes her eyes. She is not a piss-poor parent. Ainsley is merely at a trying age, and she is rebellious by nature. But if you were to strip Tabitha down to her starkest, most honest thoughts, the ones she would never dare share with another soul, she would admit that where Ainsley is concerned, she has created a monster. After Julian died, Tabitha poured all her energy into raising Ainsley. She was a helicopter parent, a second-generation helicopter parent, controlling Ainsley's every move the way Eleanor had controlled hers. But when Ainsley grew up, she did it fast. Ainsley was a runaway Mustang, and Tabitha felt the reins slipping through her hands. The way Tabitha chose to keep Ainsley close was to aid and abet her in her quest to be the most popular, most sophisticated child at Nantucket High School. Tabitha bought the makeup and the $200 jeans. Tabitha extended the curfew. The fact that Ainsley is now such a powder keg is nobody's fault but Tabitha's. Being out on the ocean always brings up these thoughts. Tabitha should have stayed on land. Suddenly, there's a man standing next to her. He's wearing a uniform. He offers his hand.
"I'm Peter," he says. "The captain."
"Tabitha Frost," she says. "If you're the captain, then who's driving the boat?"
Peter laughs. "My first mate. I asked him to take over for a second so I could come down here to chat with you. Would you like to help me steer this beauty?"
As they stand side by side at the ship's wheel, any time a crew member happens to wander in, Peter sends him off to fetch Tabitha more champagne or another plate of hors d'oeuvres. He unreels his life story. Coast Guard at 19, married by 22, two boys, named PJ and Kyle, divorced by age 30, ex-wife number one lives in Houston. Tabitha wonders how many ex-wives there are in total. The music she can hear has changed to top 40, the stuff Ainsley listens to when she's in a good mood, and Tabitha envisions the champagne going to everyone's head and the Tallahasseans contorting their bodies in awkward, embarrassing ways that approximate dancing.
"Go on," she says to Captain Peter.
Married again at age 32. The daughter from that marriage is a shooting star, 19 years old and a sophomore at Northwestern. Ex-wife number two, the mother, runs a glamorous campground on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Then, at age 35, Peter had a bit of a midlife crisis. He moved to Maui, captained a whale-watching ship for 10 years, lived with a local girl named Lupalai, and had another couple of kids, a boy and a girl, ages 14 and 11, although he and Lupalai never married. He sends checks, he says, but he hasn't seen the kids since he moved east 5 years ago. He has been the captain of the Belle for 5 summer seasons, and in the winter, he goes down to the Bahamas and runs a bareboat charter.
"I just celebrated my 50th birthday in April," he says. "How about you?"
"I'm 39, Tabitha says.
Captain Peter laughs. "All women are supposed to say that, I guess."
"No," Tabitha says. "I actually am 39. I turn 40 in December.
"Oh," the captain says.
He's caught by surprise, and Tabitha's spirit flags. She looks older. She acts older. She's wearing a white linen shift with an OB belt. It's the cornerstone of her mother's collection and has been for 30 years. It's called the Roxy. It's meant to convey a classic timelessness, and while it may certainly do that, it is neither youthful nor sexy. Tabitha should have worn the haute hippie sequined miniskirt with the hot pink Millie blouse, but she had wondered that would make her look like she was trying too hard. Instead, she looks like she's headed to the early bird special before making a fourth for bridge. The captain says something, but Tabitha doesn't hear him.
"I'm sorry?"
"Would you like to go get a drink after we dock?"
I'm about to turn this old gal around now, so you'll have to go down to the deck.
Tabitha tugs on her obi. She feels pursued and dismissed at the same time. Does she want to go for a drink with the captain? She's not sure. It's obvious he's bad news. He probably preys on every halfway decent-looking woman who boards the Belle. He's a 50-year-old man who still plays the seasonal back-and-forth game. He either rents a cottage somewhere on island, or he lives in employee housing provided by the Westmore Club. He likely doesn't own any real estate. He may drive a small pickup truck. That kind of life is okay until one turns. Tabitha randomly picks the age of 28. After 28, it's time to grow up. And how many children does Captain Peter have to support? Tabitha lost count. 4? 5? If Eleanor were here, she would veto Captain Peter immediately. Eleanor had disapproved of Wyatt because Wyatt was a house painter, and Eleanor wanted Tabitha to marry a professional man, a lawyer or someone in private equity. Now that Wyatt owns a painting contracting business that covers the entire Cape and the South Shore from Plymouth to Braintree, Eleanor is more favorably disposed toward him. She adores Ramsay, who works for his family's insurance business on Main Street. Ramsay wears a tie to work, and his family belongs to the Nantucket Yacht Club. This guy, Captain Peter, isn't the kind of guy Tabitha would ever hook up with. He's the kind of guy Harper would hook up with. Harper has no standards. Harper's bar, for everything in life, isn't just low. It's lying on the ground. Tabitha should say thank you, but no thank you.
Have you ever lost anyone? She asks.
Lost anyone? Peter says. He seems confused and anxious to get back up to the controls.
We can talk about it later, Tabitha says. I'd love to go for a drink.
As they're walking to the Nautilus, Tabitha regrets her decision. She has a text on her phone from Ainsley that says, "When are you coming home?" Ainsley has been grounded for a week after taking Tabitha's FJ-40 for a joyride in the middle of the night without permission and, more egregiously, without having a license. Tabitha discovered the transgression the previous Sunday morning when she had gotten in her car to go to a sunrise yoga class. The gas tank was empty, and the interior reeked of cigarettes. Tabitha had woken Ainsley up and demanded a confession, which Ainsley had handed over without a fuss.
Yes, I took the car. I drove to Emma's.
Emma's.
Tabitha and Ainsley live in the carriage house behind Eleanor's grand home on Cliff Road, and Ainsley's friend Emma, whose photo should appear in the dictionary next to the phrase bad influence, lives at the end of Jonathan Way in Tom Nevers, which is just about as far away as two points can get on Nantucket. Tabitha had shuddered, imagining Ainsley having an accident in the FJ-40 while she was driving unlicensed. What if she had hit someone? What if she had killed someone? Tabitha would have been sued, and Eleanor would have been sued. The business would have been sued, their livelihood destroyed. And yet Ainsley displayed no guilt. Tabitha had snapped Ainsley's phone up off the nightstand. That had gotten Ainsley's attention. She was up and out of bed in a flash, chasing Tabitha through the house, trying to wrest the phone from her mother's grip. She had scratched Tabitha's face in her frenzy, and Tabitha had been so incredulous, struck, basically, by her own child, that she had dropped the phone, and Ainsley had reclaimed it.
"I need this," Ainsley said. "You may be happy to have no social life, but that won't work for me."
"Oh, it won't?"
Tabitha said lamely. She touched the scratch on her face and looked at the smear of blood on her finger.
"Well, too bad. You're grounded."
"Ha," Ainsley said. "I'd like to know how you plan on keeping me in the house."
Tabitha had been infuriated, but she also recognized her own impotence. How would she stop Ainsley from walking out the door? Tabitha could cut off her allowance, but Emma had a steady source of income from her father, Dutch, who ran the restaurant at the airport and was never home, thus resorting to cash parenting. Emma would lend or give Ainsley money for cigarettes or weed or beer or whatever else they were buying to enhance their evening hours.
If you set foot out this door, I'll have your cell phone service suspended, Tabitha said. You'll have your physical phone, but no signal. No texting, no calls, no Snapchat, no internet. And I'll change the password on the Wi-Fi here at the house.
Ainsley had narrowed her eyes skeptically.
You would never do that.
Tabitha had recalled Ramsay's piss-poor parenting comment.
Watch me, she said.
Ainsley had then brokered a bargain. She would stay home for a week as long as she was allowed to keep her phone service. Fine. Tonight, Friday, is the last night of the grounding, thank God. Ainsley has been verbally abusive and surly all week. She eats whatever she wants, but never carries a dish to the sink. God forbid she make her bed. Tabitha has had to ask the housekeeper, Philippa, to come for 3 extra hours this week to clean up after Ainsley, and Tabitha is just waiting for Eleanor to call and give Tabitha a hard time about adding to Philippa's load. Tabitha texts Ainsley back, home late. Immediately, Ainsley responds,
what's late? Midnight?
Yes, Tabitha texts back. Her daughter thinks she has no social life. Ha. Midnight at the earliest. Then Tabitha worries that maybe Ainsley is lonely. She grew up afraid of the dark. This fear developed right after Julian died, and Tabitha never gave her another sibling to keep her company. Tabitha always had a companion growing up, Harper. Weird, Tabitha thinks. Harper has popped into her mind twice in the past hour. When is the last time that happened? And then even weirder, weird bordering on sorcery. Tabitha's phone pings, and Tabitha, although knowing it's rude to keep texting when she's on a sort of date but thinking it's a response from Ainsley, checks her phone. It's a text that is identified only as Vineyard Haven, MA. It's Harper.
There's someplace else you need to be? Captain Peter asks.
No, Tabitha says. She tucks her phone into her clutch. She'll read the text later.
Tabitha picked Nautilus because it's a place she never went with Ramsay, and what she needs more than anything is a fresh start. She has heard only good things about the restaurant, artisanal cocktails, inventive food, and she has always wanted to try it. So why not tonight? Nautilus is crowded, and the scene is young. Captain Peter hesitates before they enter.
You sure this is where you want to go?
He seems almost intimidated, which is not an attractive trait. Tabitha feels her temperature being dialed down from lukewarm to cool. She nearly resorts to asking,
well, where do you want to go?
But she doesn't want to stand outside hemming and hawing, and she does not want to end up at the Angler's Club.
Yes, she says, here.
And she leads him inside. The music is loud, and the 20-somethings and 30-somethings are hooting and hollering and ordering drinks at the bar. Tabitha is still a 30-something, she reminds herself. She approaches the hostess.
Table for two?
The hostess says, 90-minute wait for a table. You're welcome to try your luck at the bar. Tabitha strolls to the bar, holding her chin up, scanning for seats. There is one empty seat half hidden among a throng of people. Tabitha wiggles her way in and claims it. She sets her clutch confidently on the bar as if planting a flag and turns to see if Captain Peter has followed her. He has, but he looks miserable, as if she were leading him on a leash. She beams at the bartender, determined to make this work.
Menu?
She says. A menu appears. Tabitha peruses it. Normally, she orders a vodka gimlet or a glass of rosé, but come to think of it, those are drinks that Ramsay introduced her to. Before Ramsay, she drank a Mount Gay and tonic if she wanted a cocktail, or red wine with dinner, because that was what Eleanor drank. Tonight, she will have something called the Naughty Dog. She hands the menu to Peter and points at the drink.
I'll have one of these.
He whistles. $15? Tabitha closes her eyes, dialing down from cool to cold. She's okay with the fact that Peter isn't wealthy, but she can't handle anyone who complains about the price of a drink. Peter says,
I'll just have a beer, a Cisco.
He hands the menu back to Tabitha. Is she supposed to order? She wonders. She is closer to the bar than Peter is, but Peter is the man. Peter invited her for drinks. She turns back to him. He raises his eyebrows expectantly, as if he has never seen her before, then says,
I'm going out front to have a cigarette. Be right back.
A cigarette, Tabitha thinks. It's the final nail in the coffin for this date. She gets the bartender's attention, cute guy, bearded, smiley, and orders the drinks. When he brings them, the naughty dog a glorious deep red color, thanks to the Campari and the freshly squeezed grapefruit juice, Peter is still outside, which leaves Tabitha to pay. She forks over $25. The bartender gives her change, and she says, keep it.
Thanks, bae, he says,
and he gives her another smile, looking into her eyes. Bae, not ma'am. She loves him for this. Could she date the bartender? Tabitha wonders as she takes a sip of her drink. He might be 30, maybe. Is that too young? Tabitha tries to imagine Eleanor's reaction when Tabitha announces she is dating a 29-year-old bartender from Nautilus. Tabitha would have to explain it for what it is, a rebound from Ramsay. But no matter the circumstances, Tabitha doesn't sleep with bartenders. Harper does. Tabitha wonders about the text from Vineyard Haven. Tabitha and Harper have barely spoken since the horrible weeks following Julian's death, 14 years earlier. Then Tabitha remembers the voicemail from 5 or 6 weeks back, also from Vineyard Haven. It was Harper, saying that their father, Billy, was having trouble with his kidneys and had to go to the hospital. Tabitha had meant to call Billy, but the news had come at a busy time. She was having the carpet in the boutique replaced and trying to finish up all the summer buying. And then Tabitha hadn't heard anything else, so she'd assumed the problem had cleared up. Tabitha is tempted to pull her phone out to see what Harper wants, but there is nothing more pathetic in the world, in Tabitha's opinion, than a woman alone at a bar checking her phone. She takes a long swill off her drink, and when the bartender swings back by, she says, What's your name?
Zach,
he says. Zach. Probably he's younger than she thought. Zach is a name that became popular in the 90s. She turns around to see what's become of Captain Peter, but the crowd is thick and she can't locate him in it. The couple next to Tabitha stands up, and Tabitha wonders if she should snag one of the stools for Captain Peter, but before she has a chance to do so, another couple sits down. Tabitha blinks. It's Ramsay and Kaylee. Ramsay grins.
What luck?
Kaylee swivels around. She smiles at Tabitha. I'm sorry. Were you saving this seat for someone? She is so pretty. Her teeth white and straight, her hair long and shiny, tucked behind one ear. But it's her skin that Tabitha really envies. If she could go back in time and change one thing, it would be this. She would have worn sunscreen. Lots of it.
Yeah, Ramsay says. Who's the beer for?
His voice is so familiar, his wicked smirk so easy to interpret, that it's as though Kaylee unwittingly inserted herself between a long-married couple. Ramsay is the ideal life partner for Tabitha in nearly every way. But there are deal breakers. It's not only that he wants a child. It's also that he has never lost anyone, and he's incapable of understanding the depth and intensity of Tabitha's emotions. There are things that activate her Julian anxiety. Julian's birthday, obviously, and the day of his death, but also babies and boys who are now the age that Julian would have been, 14. Ramsay was impatient with Tabitha's emotional lows as they related to Julian. The more she tried to talk it through and make him understand, the more he urged her to get over it and move on. That Tabitha is now so unhappy without Ramsay has come as a surprise. That she is fiendishly jealous of Kaylee, honestly, Tabitha would like to cut her, is a shock. "That's my dates," she says. "Captain Peter." She wants the title to make him sound like a figure of authority, but it comes across as goofy. She might as well have said Captain Crunch or Captain Kangaroo.
"Guy wearing a white uniform like Meryl Stubbings?" Ramsay says. "I just saw him out front. He left."
"He left?" Tabitha says. "Have you ever lost anyone?" she thinks. She has now lost Captain Peter, but she feels only a wave of relief. Thank God he's gone. If only this news hadn't been reported by her ex-boyfriend, she would be a very happy woman indeed. She picks up Captain Peter's beer and drinks the entire thing in one pull. She has, officially, turned into her twin sister. Kaylee looks impressed. Ramsay surprised. Tabitha hides her burp behind a cupped hand.
"I'm out," she says, grabbing her clutch and blowing a kiss to young Zach. "You two have fun."
"Tabitha," Ramsay says. Tabitha looks at him. He loves her. She can see it written all over his face. But love isn't enough.
"Good night,"
she says, and she heads for the door. Tabitha can hear the music, feel the music. Hell, she can practically taste the music from two houses away. It's rap, or whatever kids call rap these days, but there are fewer tricky lyrics and a heavier bass line. When Tabitha pulls into the driveway, the music is so loud that the walls of the house seem to expand and contract. It looks like the house is breathing. Or maybe that's the effect of the naughty dog. Then Tabitha sees the cars. One is the black Range Rover that overindulged, unparented Emma drives, and the other is a white pickup that Teddy, Ainsley's boyfriend, drives. Tabitha gets out of her car and steadies herself with a hand on the hood. How has Eleanor not heard the music? She really is going deaf. It's so loud, Tabitha can't believe the neighbors haven't called the police. She opens the door into a miasma of pot smoke. This is just not possible, she thinks. But of course, it is possible. Ainsley is 16. She is grounded, and what she will no doubt say is that she hasn't left the house. She didn't ask if she could have friends over, because if she had asked, Tabitha would have said absolutely not. But because Ainsley didn't ask, and Tabitha didn't say no, Ainsley will argue that she is not technically breaking any rules. Tabitha kicks off her kitten heels. The layout of the carriage house is upside down. The bedrooms are on the ground floor, the living space upstairs. Oh, how Tabitha would love to slip into her room, take an Ambien, and go to bed. She doesn't have the energy to deal with this. "You're a piss-poor parent," she hears Ramsay say. Then she hears something else. A hollow thocking noise. Thock, thock, thock. Thock, thock, thock. No, Tabitha thinks. She ascends the stairs stealthily, thinking she would like to appraise the situation before anyone realizes she's home. She grips the handrail as the thocking continues, then stops, then starts again. The song ends. There are a few seconds of silence during which Tabitha freezes. Then Meghan Trainor starts singing that song from the previous summer, "My Name Is No." Tabitha congratulates herself for recognizing her daughter's music. Then she thinks, "My name is No. No, 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 no." She peers between the spindles of the banister at the top of the stairs to see at least a dozen kids smoking cigarettes, smoking weed, drinking cans of PBR, and yes, the source of that sickening sound, kids playing beer pong on her Stephen Swift table. "No," Tabitha says. She steps into the room and wonders which transgression to address first. She wants to turn off the music, but she is drawn over to the beautiful table, her prize piece of furniture. She grabs the paddle out of the young man's hand on his backswing, and he is so stunned that he accidentally knocks over one of the cups of beer on the table. An amber lake spreads across the sumptuous polished cherry.
Whoa,
he says. It's Ainsley's friend, BC. He's cute, dark-haired, wearing a t-shirt from Young's bicycle shop. Tabitha has the urge to beat him with the paddle. She races to the kitchen for a towel, and she finds Ainsley's phone hooked up to the iPod dock. Tabitha yanks it off, and the music stops. Tabitha is so angry that she dumps Ainsley's phone into one of the cups of beer on the kitchen counter. Someone from the living room calls out, "Music!" Another voice says, "Her mom is home." "Yes," Tabitha says, "her mom is home." "Hey, Tabitha," Emma says when Tabitha comes back into the living room to mop up the beer. Emma is slit-eyed, high as a kite, sitting on the Girvan, Tabitha's excellent turquoise tweed mid-century style sofa, between two boys.
"Emma," Tabitha says.
Tabitha hates that Emma calls her by her first name. But back when Ainsley was small, Tabitha had been so young that she couldn't fathom being called Ms. Frost, and she had never married Wyatt, so she wasn't able to use the name Mrs. Cruz. Eleanor had always insisted that Tabitha's and Harper's friends call her Mrs. Roxy Frost, which was another reason why Tabitha didn't want to call herself Ms. Frost. It was so pointlessly formal. But what Tabitha realizes now is that a title inspires respect. If Tabitha had long ago trained Emma and Ainsley's other friends to call her Ms. Frost, maybe they would have thought twice before playing beer pong on her dining room table and infusing the tweed of her sofa with the smell of marijuana smoke.
"Emma," Tabitha says, "where is Ainsley?"
Emma says. Then Tabitha figures it out. She's downstairs with Teddy. Tabitha surveys the mess. The other kids are standing in a posture of tense observation, waiting to see how she'll react. Friend or foe, they must be wondering. Will Tabitha be the cool mom, or will she call their parents? She wants to order them all out of the house. She wants them gone. But the specter of a lawsuit lingers. Emma is not okay to drive.
"Is anyone here sober?" Tabitha asks.
She herself isn't sober, not by a long shot. She had four glasses of champagne on the bell, then the naughty dog and Captain Peter's beer. She can't offer to drive any of these kids home. So what does that mean? They'll spend the night? Unthinkable. She'll have to call the parents.
"I'm sober," a voice says.
Tabitha turns. It's Candace Beasley. Tabitha nearly smiles. Ainsley and Candace were friends years and years ago, best friends, until one day, in middle school, if Tabitha remembers correctly, they weren't. Ainsley had grown up and moved on to snarkier, faster girls like Emma. Candace's mother, Stephanie, had been a great friend of Tabitha's, but they drifted apart when the girls did. Part of this was circumstance, part was by design. Tabitha felt extremely uncomfortable when she bumped into Steph at the grocery store or the dry cleaner and Steph said, "Candace really misses Ainsley." How was Tabitha to respond to that? She tried, "They're girls. Their moods change like the weather. I'm sure they'll be close again before we know it." And look, Candace is here at the party, and she is sober. Of course she's sober. She has been raised with love, attention, and, most important, boundaries. She's obedient by nature. She and her mother have the kind of relationship in which they're best friends, but Candace still knows who's boss.
"Candace," Tabitha says, "hi."
Just looking at Candace, with her grosgrain ribbon headband and her coltish legs, makes Tabitha feel like 10,000 straight pins to the heart. The ways she has failed as a parent.
"Can you make sure nobody leaves, please? I need to find Ainsley."
Candace nods. Her expression tells Tabitha that she is used to being the responsible one among her peers. Is it wrong to treat Candace as a second adult? Probably, but Tabitha can't fret about that now. She races down the stairs. The door to Ainsley's room is open, putting her unmade rat's nest of a bed on display, along with the piles of clothes, many of them Eleanor Roxy Frost originals, strewn all over the floor. At first, Tabitha thinks Ainsley has run away, and Tabitha panics. Then Tabitha notices the closed door of her own bedroom. She tries the knob. Locked.
No, Tabitha thinks. This is not happening.
She pounds on the door with the flat of her hand.
Ainsley! She screams. Ainsley!
She places her ear against the door. She can't tell if she hears rustling or if the noise is simply her brain scrambling for purchase. Would it not be bad enough if Ainsley and Teddy were having sex in Ainsley's room? Does it have to be the horror show of them screwing in Tabitha's room? In Tabitha's bed, which hasn't been used for carnal purposes since Valentine's Day, which was the last time Tabitha slept with Ramsay. She pounds again, then the door opens, and Tabitha nearly slaps her hand against Teddy's face.
Miss Frost, he says in his country and western star accent. He looks shocked. I thought you were Emma.
Teddy is bare-chested, but he has jeans on, and Tabitha can see the waistband of his boxers sticking out of the top of his jeans. His red hair is messy, and he's flushed. He has clearly just had his way with Tabitha's daughter, but Tabitha can't hate him. Teddy is sweet. Teddy is polite. She notices that he called her Ms. Frost, and Teddy is the victim of some pretty tough circumstances. He and his parents lived in Oklahoma City, but there was a fire at the Nestle Purina factory, and Teddy's father, a captain with the OCFD, was killed. That is why Tabitha likes Teddy. Teddy has lost someone. Teddy's mother subsequently fell apart and tried to take her own life. She is now at a psychiatric hospital in Tulsa, and Teddy was shipped to his only other living relative, his father's brother, Graham Elquot, who is a scalper here on Nantucket. In the summertime, when scalloping season is suspended, Graham works as a raw bar shucker for all the fancy cocktail parties. Tabitha saw him in action over Memorial Day weekend at the Figawi tent, but she didn't have the courage to introduce herself as Ainsley's mother. Behind Teddy, the room is shadowy.
Get your clothes on, Teddy, Tabitha says. Are you sober?
Yes, ma'am,
Teddy says, and Tabitha believes him.
I want you to drive some kids home. You take half, and Candace will take half.
Teddy nods.
Send Ainsley out, please, Tabitha says.
Her daughter emerges 30 seconds later wearing a vintage Janet Russo sundress of Tabitha's. She has had sex in Tabitha's bed, raided Tabitha's closet, and turned the living room into a Jersey Shore arcade. Tabitha worries that Ainsley will be defiant, but she looks ashamed. Actually, that might be overstating it. She looks mildly contrite.
You said midnight at the earliest, Ainsley says. I planned on having everyone out and everything cleaned up by then. As if that makes it okay, Tabitha says. Please, Ainsley says, please don't be a buzzkill.
Candace takes half the kids, including Emma, home in Emma's Range Rover, and Teddy takes the rest of the kids home in his uncle's truck. Tabitha tells Ainsley she's not going to bed until the upstairs is spotless. There are rings on the Stephen Swift table that will never come out.
Do you have any idea how much money this table cost me? Tabitha asks.
Then, before Ainsley can answer, she says,
$20,000. Do you ever listen to yourself, Tabitha? Ainsley says. You are so materialistic.
Do you ever listen to yourself? Tabitha thinks. You sound like a privileged, entitled snot.
Do not, Tabitha says, call me that.
Why not? Ainsley says. Emma calls her father by his first name.
It shouldn't be your aspiration to be like Emma, Tabitha says. That girl is bad news. Always has been, always will be.
Always has been, always will be,
Ainsley says in a high, mocking tone. You're so judgmental. Tabitha is about to say that she's supposed to be judgmental where Ainsley is concerned, because how else will Ainsley figure out what's acceptable behavior and what's not? But this will no doubt end up sparking angry responses, coming one after another like an endless string of firecrackers. Tabitha lets it go. They get the table returned to its usual place, moving it together, which feels sort of okay. 30 seconds of a common goal. Tabitha empties the ashtrays and tosses out the roaches. She and Ainsley throw the beer cans in the recycling pile.
So, Ainsley says, you came home early. How was your night?
Oh, how Tabitha would love to change the tenor of the evening by sinking into the Girvan and telling her daughter about her night. The party on the Bell, meeting the captain, going to Nautilus, bumping into Ramsay. But Tabitha recognizes Ainsley's words for what they are, a strategy. Ainsley has never once asked Tabitha about her night. Ainsley is painfully self-absorbed. Ainsley asking now is Ainsley wanting to butter Tabitha up so that Tabitha forgets she's supposed to punish Ainsley. It doesn't matter how Tabitha fields the question, because at that moment, Ainsley finds the cup in the kitchen that contains her submerged phone. The scream could shatter glass. Tabitha feels a childish sense of triumph. Gotcha, she thinks. Later, when Tabitha is lying in Ainsley's bed, she isn't about to sleep in her own bed after what happened, and Tabitha is wondering just whose flawed genes her daughter inherited. She remembers Harper's text. She checks her phone. It is now 12:15 a.m., the hour she was expected home. She clicks on Vineyard Haven, MA. The text says, Billy is gone.